years as a parish priest in the Church of England. And after that, he was Dean of King's College, Cambridge, from 1991 to 2001. He taught practical theology for 2 years at the University of Aarhus in Denmark, before becoming Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity at the University of Oxford, 2004 to 2013. From 2013, he was teaching in University of Glasgow. Professor Pattison has many publications, many books. I will introduce two or three of his very important textbooks. One of his books is The Mystical Sources of Existentialist Thought, Being, Beingness, Love. And the second, A Monology of the Devout Life, A Philosophy of Christian Life. This book is part one of a greater project. And he has some texts on Heidegger, for example, Heidegger on This, a critical theological essay. And I must say that as I was a student, I read one of his books on Heidegger, and I found his book one of the best books in English language about Heidegger. After that, I've read Heidegger in general, but in English, his book one of the best books. Professor Pattison, thank you very much that you accepted our invitation, and I am grateful that you accepted to teach in our winter school 3 sessions. Eagerly, we are heaving to your lectures. Thank you very much.
Good. Salam, and thank you very much for the invitation. I'm honored and excited to be here. I shall try to speak fairly clearly and slowly, but if at any point you find I'm going too fast or you wish something to be repeated, please just say, and I will say it again more slowly or more clearly. I think it's very exciting for me to engage with you today. I've been aware of the great intellectual traditions of Iran for many years, and about 15 years ago, was privileged to take part in a short conference on Heidegger in Tehran and to meet some of the Heidegger scholars there. My talks over the next few days relate particularly to the questions 3 and 4 on Professor Isfahani's list of topics for this school, that is, questions relating to the meaning of truth in the philosophy of religion, but also to question 5, the place of philosophy of religion in the modern world. Now, I think this was touched on also in the lecture on feminism and philosophy of religion, that philosophy of religion is always takes place in a particular culture, particular moment of history. If we go back to Hegel, Hegel said that philosophy, one side of philosophy is rooted in the need of the time, in its own particular historical moment, what that historical moment asks of the philosopher. In terms of my context and my situation, it's become clear in the last few years that Britain, each of its parts, England, Scotland, and Wales, Northern Ireland different, Britain is not only post-Christian, but is also post-religious. In a recent survey, the majority of people in Britain today say they have no religion. This is clearly a challenge for philosophy of religion, not least because the ideas that people have about religion are often shaped by a hostile or perhaps an ignorant media. So there are caricatures of religion are confused with the thing itself. But it does mean that the philosopher of religion can't presuppose any knowledge of religion in the general philosophical community. If you go back to the 1960s, when I started this study, if you went to a public library, you would find works by leading philosophers on the shelves for borrowing by ordinary people. Today, these are only found in specialist libraries. So that there is no public understanding of some of the basic ideas and concepts of philosophy of religion. So in my recent work, the three volumes mentioned in the introduction on the philosophy of Christian life, I'm trying to approach the philosophy of religion in a way that accepts, as it were, this context of non-knowledge. Therefore, it does not begin with doctrinal or theoretical claims about, for example, God, the existence of God, the attributes of God, immortality, but with the lived experience of religion. Now, of course, this situation I've described, I understand, is very different from the situation in Iran, but I want to make clear that, in a way, everything I say is coloured by this British context of post-religious society. Right. Now, if we say we want to start with the experience of lived religious life, an immediate objection or an immediate thought is that experience is as varied as each individual. Every individual experiences the world in a slightly different way. So does this mean abandoning the attempt to consider the truth of religious claims? If we say we start with experience, are we giving up on the question of truth? I don't think we are, but we approach this question in another way. The way I'm choosing is that of existential phenomenology. Now, phenomenology itself is a very broad form of philosophy that has many varieties. The kind of phenomenology that was influential in the phenomenology of religion in Britain in the period from the 1960s to about 10 years ago was what we might call comparative phenomenology. This meant looking across the field at different religions and their commonalities. So, for example, we in Britain have just had Christmas. Our Jewish community has just had Hanukkah. The Hindu community has just had Diwali. So people say, well, if you look at different religions, they all have a festival of light. What is the meaning of a festival of light? We might say that Christianity, Judaism, and Islam also have a season of fasting. So you look at the season of fasting as a phenomenon. In both cases, you abstract from the particular experience of Christians, Hindus, Jews, Muslims. So what people are looking for in that way are certain universal structures of religion, which is if it is a natural feature of human life in the world. Now, for me, the problem with that approach is precisely that it abstracts from the concreteness of lived experience. So the Hindu festival of light actually doesn't mean the same as Christmas means for Christians, that the experience of these apparently similar forms of religious life is shaped by the whole concrete matrix of beliefs and practices specific to particular traditions. So for me, existential phenomenology is far more concrete. It begins with the concrete and the particular. Now, my main model for this is, it's actually about 100 years old. It is the lectures on religious life that Heidegger gave shortly after the First World War. I have to say that these lectures were so unusual and surprising that the students complained that this wasn't really philosophy, and Heidegger had to abandon one course in the middle. In these lectures, Heidegger focused on particular religious thinkers, chiefly Paul the Apostle and Augustine. So Heidegger takes the letters of St. Paul from the Christian New Testament, subjects them to a phenomenological reading. So he's looking at religion in general, he's looking specifically at the lived Christian spirit of Paul, and he does the same with Augustine as well. In one point in the 1920s, that Augustine, Luther, and Kierkegaard were philosophically essential. So he's using a religious spirit, very concrete individual of religious life. But of course, not them in the way that Theodore reading. He's reading them, find out what basic structures of human existence reveal. So in Kierkegaard, for example, who becomes perhaps the most important of these, according to Heidegger, Kierkegaard offers a thorough, radical quiz to logicity. His question is based in Denmark in the 1840s, 1850s. But Heidegger says, Kierkegaard himself did not analyze this, did not interpret it philosophical way. Kierkegaard's aim, promote Christianity, to call his contemporaries to a more serious religious commitment, to take their own religion more seriously. That was his aim. In doing so, he showed a great deal about what it means to be a, about the confrontation with death, about the ethical requirement, about the nature of language. But he doesn't focus on these philosophically. Heidegger says that what he wants
Excuse me. Perhaps Dickens, that's hear you a little not sharp. Is yes. It perhaps something in your internet can be modified, or it is not possible?
I don't know that.
If you have no, if you have nothing to change, we will.
I can't see anything that I could change here. Can you hear me clearly now? It is okay?
We can hear you.
Okay.
It is good that you perhaps repeat the last 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, the chief point I'm making here is that in Being and Time, other writers, Heidegger draws very heavily on religious writers, especially Kierkegaard. But he says Kierkegaard is writing as a Christian for Christians, not as a philosopher. So Heidegger uses what Kierkegaard has written to give a, what he calls a fundamental ontological analysis of human existence. So, and he calls the distinction between the ontic and the ontological. Kierkegaard remains at the ontic level, which, if you like, is the level of everyday life. Heidegger wants to take this down, take this deeper to the ontological level, to the fundamental structures of human existence. Now, why is religious life particularly significant here? Why am I taking religious life as a focus? Why not, for example, business or sport? Or life as an actor? Well, of course, you could do any of these things and analyze them existentially. Many people have. I think you can go to libraries and find books on the phenomenology of sport. But I think religion, like philosophy, is concerned with life as a whole. A sport is only one part of life. Of course, people who are professional sportsmen and women commit themselves completely to it, but it doesn't necessarily affect the rest of their lives in the same way. They have families, they have six, they have, these lie outside the practice of sport. Whereas religion extends to all areas of life. It concerns life as a whole. It is about how I commit myself to my life. So, like philosophy, religion is concerned with the whole, but it has the character of a life project rather than philosophical reflection. So again, I ask the question, does this mean abandoning the search for truth? Does the religious person just say, well, this is my religion, this is what I believe, this is how I'm going to practice? Not at all. But we need to draw in some other ways of looking at truth. And I want to mention four thinkers I've drawn on in thinking about truth. The first is the contemporary German philosopher Jürgen Habermas. And Habermas, with a background in social theory, identifies actually three different kinds of truth. There is the kind of truth that is at issue in science and technology, what he calls constative knowledge. What is the case? How do certain atoms behave in the molecule? Got nothing to do with, I think I'd like to be the case, but what is the case? Then there are also normative truths, what we should do, what one might call ethics or morality. And then there are expressive truths that show how we feel about ourselves and about the world, which is the domain of art. And Habermas thinks also religion, that religion is an expressive kind of truth. You can see this basic difference here, I think, if we think of a medical operation. When the patient has had anesthetic and is unconscious, the doctor approaches the patient simply as a body. In a way, it's no different from mending a car or any other machine that has gone wrong. But of course, when the patient is awake, the illness connects to their family life, their work, their interests. It has a human meaning as well. Same illness will affect different people very different ways according as to how we express ourselves. Now, the scientist may not be interested in that at all, but Habermas says we need all of these elements of truth to be integrated into one another if we are to get the whole picture. And he says one of the problems with Western society, at least, is that the discourse of scientific and technological knowledge has taken over just about everything else. And we need to get the balance back. A second approach to truth is that of Heidegger, who famously defined truth in terms of the Greek term aleia, which he translated as, very roughly, unconcealment, bringing the world out of concealment. The basic character of language was what he called apophantic, which is connected with the word phenomenology through the Greek root phainestai, to show itself. So for Heidegger, it's language that does this, that brings the world out of concealment, opens it up so that we can see it for what it is. There's a beautiful example of this in the writings of Helen Keller. Helen Keller was a woman born in the 19th century who was deaf, dumb, and blind. And until the age of about 7 or 8, she was incapable of communicating with the people around her. Then she got a new teacher who came into her life and changed it forever. Teacher took her out into the garden and worked a water pump to pour water over her arm. And then while she was pouring the water, the teacher wrote the words, W-A-T-E-R, meaning water. And suddenly, as Helen Keller writes, I'm quoting her words now, suddenly I felt a misty consciousness, as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought. And somehow, the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that w-a-t-a-r-a meant the wonderful cool something that was flowing over my hand. The living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. And as Helen Keller says, her life before the teacher came was dark, isolated, solitary. She had a world. Everything was chaotic. She didn't experience any connection between anything that happened. A dark emotional turmoil. But language opened the world to her, and though she was blind, enabled her to see the world and to see herself. I think that's a beautiful illustration of Heidegger's idea of language as opening the world. One can say that a great deal of art, literature, philosophy does that. It opens up things that we've never seen. A writer writes about the world in a new way, and suddenly we see things we've never before seen. I think Heidegger's work does that. He helped us to look at ourselves, at the human situation, in a new way. But then the question comes back, well, is it true? And there are a great many works of literature that change the way we look at the world, but maybe they're not true. Maybe they're not good. Maybe they have a bad effect on us. I'll pick this question of literature up later on in the third lecture. But so language basically here, truth as unconcealment, as coming out into the open. Language as a key role. Now the third view I want to take into account is that of Rudolf Bultmann. Bultmann was a friend and a colleague of Heidegger's in the 1920s, and he was a Christian theologian, a specialist in the Bible. And for Bultmann, the most important characteristic of truth in the Bible is not this openness that Heidegger talks about, but its endurance, its lasting quality. Truth abides. The word of the Lord lasts forever. Now we can say this is one characteristic of truth, is that it lasts. There's not one truth today and a different truth tomorrow and a different truth the day after. Truth has a constancy, and not every revelation of the world has this quality of endurance. In the sphere of philosophy, we often have the experience of some new philosophy comes along, creates a great deal of excitement. Even the newspapers write about it, television programs, and then 10 years later, it's more or less completely forgotten. Whereas, of course, we're still reading Plato, still reading Aristotle, still reading Plotinus. The really great thinkers, true philosophy, has this quality of lasting. We're still reading Heidegger, for all his failings, 100 years on from his early lectures. Now, that's, you can't say just because something lasts, it's true, but endurance, quality of lasting, is one criteria of truth. Truth isn't here today and gone tomorrow. The final figure I want to mention at this point is the Russian philosopher Pavel Florensky, an extraordinary person who was both a Christian priest and an electrical engineer, and was very active in the electrification of the Soviet Union, but died in the Gulag. Very idiosyncratic and eccentric, but said important things. Florensky also used the Greek word aletheia, but he interpreted it a little bit differently from Heidegger. He connected it to lethe, forgetfulness, In Greek mythology, the souls of the dead had to pass through the waters of Lethe, the waters of forgetfulness, into the afterlife, to forget about their life on earth. But for Florensky, truth was against forgetfulness. It was to do with remembering, but he used the German word, the struggle against Schlafsucht, struggle against wanting to fall asleep, not being attentive. What this brings out is that truth isn't just a once and for all revelation, but is a constant engagement to bring about illumination of existence. You can't just say, well, that's the truth. We found it. We'll put it on side. It's a fact. The Battle of Waterloo happened in 1815. That's that. But one has to keep on constantly struggling with truth. So we might say God is good. You might say, well, that's true. But for God is good to be meaningful, we have to keep on showing and struggling, show what it means to say that God is good. Again, this is something I'll come back to. Importantly, for both Bultmann and for Florensky, truth also has a certain personal content. Truth isn't just about facts detached from the whole of human experience, but truth is a quality of personal life. I come back to existential phenomenology and the quest for truth in existential phenomenology. Now, of course, if you look back historically at existential thought in the 20th century, different existential philosophers seem to come up with different results. For Heidegger, for the early Heidegger, it seems to be thrownness towards death is the most basic issue in human existence. For Jean-Paul Sartre, a generation later, it is freedom, the complete freedom without responsibility of the individual. For both Heidegger and Sartre, existential phenomenology is essentially atheistic. Now, of course, for a philosophy of religion, finds human life fundamentally oriented towards the God relationship. So how does one decide between these different outcomes of existential phenomenology? I think there are a number of different criteria, one of which is simply descriptive adequacy, descriptive adequacy. So when Heidegger writes about death, for example, he says the only proper way to think about death is to think about my own death. Now, not somebody else is dead, somebody else is dying, but me, I'm going to die. The French philosopher, the French Christian philosopher, Gabriel Marcel, criticized this and said, actually, my own death isn't the most important. It's the death of others. And I think that's right, because when I think about my own death, even if I was very sick, even if my doctor had told me I only have 2 days to live, my death is still a future event. It's not something here and now. It's not actual. It's only a possibility. But when someone I love dies, like my mother, my spouse, this is a real event that changes my life. They are dead. They are gone. The world is different. This isn't just a possibility. This is a reality. So it seems to me that we can say that Marcel's account is actually truer to our lived experience in relation to death than Heidegger's. Of course, we can argue and discuss this at length. Another example. For Jean-Paul Sartre, the experience of myself entails the annihilation of the world. I experience myself in opposition to the world. again, Gail Marshall, no, this is wrong. If we look at our basic experience of the world, look at the child, and the child who says, well, here I am. What joy. Our basic experience of being in the world is delight and excitement, not dread. So I could come and say, is this existential description adequate to its subject? As I've said, in wanting to understand religious life, I'm taking a particular set of religious texts. So does this mean I prejudice the outcome? If I take a text by a religious author who believes in God, I say at the end, this shows that we can believe in God. Well, that's obvious in a way. So am I loading the dice? My aim is not to prove that religion is right, as it were, that believing religious believers are right to believe in God, that there is a God to believe in, but that living religiously with a belief in God, living one's life for the sake of in obedience to God, is a humanly possible and meaningful way of living, that it's a way of living that addresses and fulfills the basic desires of human being in the world. Again, I'd underline that I'm working in the context of a post-religious society, but for many of my contemporaries here in Britain, to be religious is, if you like, to be deluded. It is to be mad in some way. It's not to live an inadequate life, not to be living a full human life. So my argument is to show that religious life, Christian life in particular, can offer a fully human way of living. And I focus, as was mentioned in the introduction, on what I call the devout life, a phenomenology of the devout life. What do I mean by this? Obviously, if we're going to take a concrete religious text, there is an enormous choice to be had. Heidegger, as we've seen, focused on St. Paul and Augustine, then Kierkegaard. The choice is much bigger than that. It's the Bible. There are ancient texts, there are medieval texts, there are modern texts. I chose to focus my study on the literature of the devout life. Meaning by that, what is also referred to sometimes as the French school of the 17th century. Why did I choose this? A first and very important point is that this is post-Copernican, that the writer writing the aftermath of Copernicus's cosmological revolution. Of course, science has developed enormously since the 17th century, but this is a kind of watershed. They realize that the universe is open in a way that our medieval and classical forebears hadn't. They are contemporaries of Pascal, and they're contemporaries of Descartes. Importantly, their writings recycle traditions of patristic and medieval traditions of Christian spirituality, including the Rhineland mysticism of Eckhart, Paula, also the Spanish mysticism of John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, so that they are in that way representative of broad Christian tradition. Then thirdly, in fact, they have been hugely influential in shaping the idea of Christian devotion in the modern world, chiefly in Catholicism, but also widely read in Protestantism. When I first started to take my religion seriously as a young adult, the priest I went to recommended me François de Sales' Introduction to the Devout Life as a book to read. I don't think anyone today would, but then it was still possible. So they're post-Copernican, they're essentially modern, they work with tradition, they have in fact been hugely influential. But obviously these are Christian texts, So does this focus mean that I'm cutting out, as it were, a dialogue with other religions? I don't think so. Again, to go back to Heidegger, he started with a particular form of lived life, and through that particular form, he sought the fundamental structures underlying it. And he believed these fundamental structures were valid for all human beings. So we can think of two analogies. If you're looking for oil underneath the earth, there are huge seas of oil, but to get to them, you have to drill down at one particular point. So you have a very narrow line, but that enables you to tap into this huge resource. Another analogy might be psychoanalysis. So if you're Freud and you're analyzing a patient, maybe there's some mistake the patient makes when they're speaking. They confuse their words. Just a small thing. You or I wouldn't notice it. But for the skilled psychotherapist, they can see that that mistake, as it were, reveals a deep and important underlying problem. So just a small thing. Or we could say a doctor too, something that we might think isn't important, a little spot here or a little spot there. They see this as a symptom of something much bigger. So though I start with the specific and the local, with the Christian, this isn't to shut out other perspectives, but it's in order to get to a different level. And interestingly, as a matter of fact, of course, the Christian tradition has never operated in isolation. It came to birth in the ancient world, in Dark Judaism, with Platonic philosophy, later in the Middle Ages with Aristotle, of course, also Jewish and Muslim thinkers who were also working with the Greek philosophical tradition, and these influenced Christianity as well. In the devout school literature, there is a quite specific role relating to the person of Rabi'a al-Adawiyya, who, the story of whom came back to the West in the Middle Ages. So here is a picture from the 17th century. Just trying to get this the right place on the screen. Yes. So this isn't. So it's a 17th century figure called the figure of charity. Its original context is forgotten, but it's the figure of a woman holding a burning pot in one hand with smoke pouring out and a jug of water in the other. And according to the legend that was brought back to the West, there was this woman went about the streets of Accra with a bowl of burning substance in one hand and a pitcher of water in the other. And when she was asked why she did this, she said, so the smoke was to blot out the idea of heaven, and the water was to douse the flames of hell. In other words, that we love God not for the sake of gaining heaven or escaping hell, but simply for the love of God, the idea of a pure love of God. And this became one of the key ideas of the French school, that it was possible to live a pure love of God. Now, this was hugely controversial. I'll come back to that in a later lecture. But for many in the French church, this was a very bad idea indeed. For them, the Bible teaches that God rewards those who obey him, and he punishes those who disobey him, just as the earthly king rewards his friends and punishes his enemies. And it would not only be bad theology, it would also undermine earthly authority if we taught that love should be pure, that it should be unmotivated by anything except love itself. Interestingly for me, what this idea of a pure love of God brings into focus is the possibility of the God relationship as such, of a very particular distinctively religious God relationship. So although there's a great deal in the devout life literature that is very specific to 17th century France, very different already from my world, of course, it takes us to a basic claim of religion, that the God relationship is a distinctive relationship, has its own logic, as it were, its own inalienable character. Now, importantly, the devout life literature isn't, for the most part, theological. The two key figures here are François de Sales, who was Bishop of Geneva, and Archbishop Fenelon. Most of their writings are practical. But the key work of François de Sales is An Introduction to the Devout Life. And this is written as a manual for how to pray. It's addressed to a concrete individual, a fictional individual he calls Philothea, a woman who loves God. And he tells her how to begin praying, what to do, how to live as a Christian in the world. His other major work, A Treatise on the Love of God, is a collection of talks given to religious women, to nuns in religious houses. Archbishop Fenelon, it's true, is more theoretical. He does write philosophical works such as A Proof for the Existence of God from the Nothingness of Human Existence. He also wrote political treaties, Telemachus. He was, incidentally, tutor to the grandson of Louis XIV, the French king, so he was a very influential figure at court, and he gave the Duke of Burgundy, that was the grandson's name, advice on how to be a good ruler. An important genre of this literature are letters of direction, where people wrote to them, mostly, but not only women, wrote to them saying, I'm trying to pray, but I have this problem, or I have some moral problem in my life, what am I to do about it? And they would write back. They also insisted that the person who is beginning the devout life needs to find a spiritual director. But they don't just do it on their own, but they have someone to guide them and help them. And already I think this is teaching us an important lesson about the nature of the devout life, and that is that the devout life isn't just what an individual does, but the devout life is a shared enterprise, that it's something that people do together. William James said that religion is what a person does with their solitude. But I think that for the devout life literature, religion is essentially shared. It's not a solitary task in that way. I will stop there with that introduction. I just briefly recap. So the aim is to find a way of doing philosophy of religion that makes sense in the context of a post-religious secular society. I find existential phenomenology to be the way forward here, with the great example being Heidegger's lectures on religious life. I don't think this is abandoning search for truth, but it is looking for religious truth as a way of opening up the world, as having a quality of permanence and lasting, but involving us also in a constant struggle. I use a very specific set of texts because I think one has to start somewhere, which is the literature of the French school of the 17th century, which is post-Copernican, representative of a large stream of Christian tradition and influential in shaping Christianity in the modern world. And although my focus is specifically on these Christian writers, the aim is to discover something more universal about the human experience of the God relationship as such. that I'll stop there for now and for the opportunity for us to have some discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you allow me, I will ask the first question. And the other participants will ask their question after it. It is helpful when, in a few words, you explain how, in context of these three lectures, this part one takes place, and a little about the other two lectures, perhaps two, three sentences.
Okay, yes. So this first lecture sets the stage, so to speak, shows how I want to begin. The second lecture looks at, specifically at the model of the self, the understanding of selfhood that emerges in the devout life literature, and considers the differences, as it were, between this devout self, this religious self, if you like, and the secular self with its idea of autonomy. The third lecture moves on to one of these distinctions, is that secular self, the self defined by autonomy, if you like, lives for itself and by itself, makes its own decisions based on its own ideas. The devout self understands itself as called by God, that the idea of vocation has a central place here. So the third lecture looks at what does it mean to understand existence as being called? What does this tell us about the human being and about the human being's search for a truthful way of living? It's a small point, but interestingly, my starting point in the third lecture is again Heidegger, who wrote to his wife at the end of the First World War that he was wanting to re-establish, restart philosophy, if you like, on a new basis. And he wanted to put the idea of calling, of vocation, at the very basis of philosophy. So that's a very short indication of how I'm going to move on in the other lectures. I can say more, obviously.
Okay, very nice. Would you please tell also two, three more sentences how you used the notion of aletheia or truth by Heidegger in this lecture again?
Yes. And clearly for Heidegger, aletheia is bringing out of concealment. And I think, again, I emphasize my own context, that I think that in this post-religious secular Britain, people have a very, well, superficial knowledge of religion. They just don't see the point of it. And a study of this literature helps to bring out some of the important elements of living a religious life that, if you like, have become invisible in the modern secular world. So the modern secular world tends to see religion solely in terms of subordination to a heteronomic authority, whether that is the church, or the Bible, or the Quran, or whatever source of religious authority it is. But what is not seen is the way in which religion can, if you like, provide an organizing focus for the whole of a human life. So wanting to bring out, this has fallen from visibility, it's become invisible, and what I want to do is to bring back into visibility, if you like, to unconceal, as it were, what is going on in the religious life. But to do so starting with this lived human experience of it, rather than the theological doctrines.
Okay, I see. And the last small question is the word vocation translation for Berufung auf Deutsch?
Yes, it's, I'll say a bit more about this, but it's interesting that according to German dictionaries and sources I've consulted, in the 16th century, the words Beruf and Berufung were interchangeable. Berufung, of course, is a more active verbal form. So you could say in English, call, calling. So when Heidegger says he wants to re-establish philosophy on the basis of vocation, he uses Berufung. And the dictionaries say actually at the beginning of the 20th century, that word is hardly used anymore. It's archaic. People only talk about Beruf. And also by the beginning of the 20th century, Betty Jones' job. Three people, a priest or a monk, have Beruf called okay. But in secular society, Beruf just meant having a job, paid employment. But Heidegger goes back to this older form, Berufung, the experience of being called, a kind of active process of being called. I'll say more about that again in the last lecture.
Thank you very much. All my colleagues, Professor Akram had a question.
Thank you, Dr. Esfani, and thank you very much, Professor Patterson, for this wonderful presentation. I don't know where to begin, but maybe some autobiographical introduction may help to set the stage for my question. I have come from a traditional Shi tradition on the one hand, and then I began to study philosophy of religion, different types of philosophy of religion, but I became very much interested in a type of philosophy of religion presented by the late Professor John Hick. I'm sure you are familiar with. So I read his books, and I did my PhD at McGill University in Canada, and then my wife went to England for her PhD studies on women's studies, and those years when we were in Birmingham, I had the chance to meet regularly with John almost every other week. We had lunch at the University of Birmingham's restaurant, actually. And also I had conversation with Professor Alan Flantinga, and a little bit with Richard Swinburne and others as well. But a lot of conversations with John in particular. On the other hand, I am quite familiar and very much in love with our mystical literature. In particular, I have taught Rumi in both in Farsi and English. And I'm generally familiar with Meister Eckhart, Teresa of Avila, Julian of Norwich, and many other mystical figures in the Western tradition. In particular, I have read Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis, and also the more difficult book, The Cloud of Unknowing, by that anonymous author. So this may help me at least to form my question. On the one hand, we see so much depth and beauty and help in our mystical traditions, being it Christian or Islamic or Buddhist or whatever. On the other hand, we are challenged by questions of in epistemology, in philosophy of religion, Hume's critique, Kant's critique, and also the very outstanding challenge of religious diversity, which makes it a little bit, at least intellectually, if not existentially and mystically and personally, at least intellectually difficult to reconcile these two sides. I'm wondering how you navigate between these two sides and how you formulate your own solution to this kind of problem that on the one hand, we see the value of religious life. On the other hand, we see so much challenges to religious life, especially in the modern world, raised by so many other reasons and factors, including these philosophical challenges. And the interesting thing for me is to how to, because you are trying to reconcile between philosophy of religion on the one hand and this kind of devotional life that you are emphasizing in your lecture. Thank you very much.
Yes, well, it is difficult. I go back to what I was saying about Florensky in particular, who makes clear that this struggle is constant, the struggle against forgetfulness. It's like when you want to go to sleep, but you need to keep awake. You're very tired. You've been traveled 24 hours. You've got to keep awake. But this is not easy. And of course, when particularly, but maybe not only, when you live in a very secular post-religious society as I do, where the irrelevance of religion, or the badness of religion, or the incomprehensibility of religion is constantly being presented in the media, in serious writing as well. You know, the struggle is all the harder. I mean, and this has been a huge change. It's actually a very, very sudden change, I think, in Britain in my lifetime, in 1970. I think it was still the majority of people still understood themselves as Christian, or obviously other people understand themselves as Muslim or Hindu, but still a very, very clear religious majority. And in the last 20 to 30 years, this has changed very, very suddenly. So to keep the viability of a religious view of life going is not difficult. And that's partly why I start with as well the lived experience of living the religious life, the human experience, if you like, of living the religious life, because as a human experience, that at least is humanly understandable to other human beings who have different kinds of human experience. As human beings, we are all here together. But of course, it doesn't stop there. That is only a beginning. In a way, everything I've said, everything I will say in these three lectures is only a kind of prolegomenon to the philosophy of religion, to considering the kind of theoretical question, the traditional gender of philosophy of religion, the nature of God, the attributes of God, logical and philosophical problems, questions arising out of that. Again, I think I mentioned Hegel at the beginning, and I think one can see in Hegel this movement. He says, you know, you start with the need of the present, but the need of the present leads you on to investigate, as it were, the whole context of the present, which is the whole context of history, which is the whole context of our biology, our planetary life, which is the whole context of our intellectual formation as well. And this leads you to, as it were, the realm of ideas, which for Hegel is timeless and eternal. But then for him, there is, you know, a Kreislauf, a circulation between the two, between the experience of the present and the contemplation of the eternal ideas, that again, because for Hegel, spirit is not static, immobile, but is pouring itself out. So the eternal self-giving of spirit leads us back into the world again, back into the experience of history. So that in a sense, there is no end. It is round and round. Now, I'm not Hegel, and I don't claim to achieve what Hegel claimed to achieve. But so this is maybe just prolegomena to a more fully and adequate theoretical philosophy of religion. But my worry is so that in the 1970s, you know, we all studied John Hick, as you say, it's one of our key textbooks. If one takes something like Evil and the God of Love, and I think that's still helpful for students, certainly. But as I say, in this post-religious society, many people would not even ask the question. It's no longer a burning question in the way that it was in the 20 or 30 years of experience of world wars. So we need somehow to begin again. Does that address your question?
If I'm allowed to continue, of course. Of course you did. You did it wonderfully. But hopefully we will hear more from you on these burning issues that we're struggling with in your coming lectures as well. So I'll wait to hear more from you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Give the time, offer the time to others.
Okay, is there any other questions?
Can you read the question, or I must read it?
Yes. Now, is there any relation between truth and time in existential phenomenology? Yeah, this is an enormous question, of course. Heidegger's big work that everyone knows him for is, of course, called Being and Time, where he sets out his view that time is the horizon of the meaning of being. Our experience of being is meaningful only in, with, and under the conditions of time. But the meaning of our own life cannot be separated from our experience of time, which for Heidegger, I don't want to get distracted by this, but for Heidegger, of course, famously, this means we know ourselves as moving inexorably towards death. To be in time is to be thrown towards death. Of course, this emphasis on time is already there in Hegel, of Hegel's big revolutions in philosophy, that instead of looking at the structures of human thought in abstraction from history and time, he saw these in a historical perspective. But, as I was saying in answer to the last question, Hegel still believed that through the interpretation of what was temporal, what was historical, we could reach, as it were, the level of timeless truths. We could see the world, to use Spinoza's phrase, sub specie aeternitatis. We could see the world in an eternal perspective. Heidegger seems to offer something much more radical. For him, there is no eternal perspective. Indeed, in a footnote in Being and Time, he criticizes Kierkegaard. He says Kierkegaard has thought very incisively, penetratingly about time, but he still thinks about time in contrast to eternity. And for Heidegger, we have to let eternity go. And this is, of course, connected with one of the objections that many religious believers, but not only religious believers, other kinds of philosophers as well, were worried that existential phenomenology opened the door to complete relativism, that there is nothing that lasts. Everything disappears into flux, that there is therefore no final meaning in history. Now, that certainly wasn't Heidegger's aim, but because he thought clearly that truth was discoverable, but it wasn't discoverable in abstraction from, or in such a way that it could be detached from, the lived experience of time, through existing in time, through language as an event occurring in time. So the question is, if everything is thoroughly temporal, if we are pervaded through and through by temporality, can there be any truth? Again, as in answer to a previous question, this is and has to be a constant struggle. But as my reference to Bultmann and the quality of truth is enduring, one can say, who knows whether the philosophy of Plato will last forever, whether there might not come a time 10,000 years from now in the future, if there is 10,000 years in the future, whether people are still reading Plato. So you might say a great thinker's thought lasts for a long time, but are they eternal? That's another thing. We can't know that. We have to struggle to continue to retrieve what is important and valuable from the thinking of the past. I think this is why, or one of the reasons why, Heidegger's own philosophy is developed through a constant dialogue with the past, through lectures on Aristotle, Plato, Kant, the German idealists all the time. He's trying to retrieve what is still living in the thought of the past. And this hermeneutic exercise to rediscover and keep on rediscovering the truth of the past seems to me a very important part of the search for truth. One Kierkegaardian idea that Heidegger uses, I think, in Being in Time is the idea of repetition. For Kierkegaard, repetition was a key aspect of human existence in time. We don't have truth, as it were, as a possession that we have. But we have to keep on repeating the discovery of truth, doing it again and again. Let's say I was an actor and I learnt my part in a play. I could repeat my lines. I knew them off by heart. It wasn't any difficulty to say them. Even so, every day when I go on stage, I have to give meaning to these lines. I don't just repeat them in a flat, boring way. I have to make them live. I have to make the character live again and again and again. So we can have truth only under the condition of repetition, not there once and for all. And one more thing, but before I finish there, I think that's also why one can say this is there already in Plato, is that pedagogy, the experience of teaching and learning, is integral to philosophy. Hegel again insists on this, that it's philosophy is not just a matter of reaching certain conclusions, but it's about a way of thinking, a way of approaching the world, a way of reflecting upon ourselves. I hope that helps. I can see there's another long question that I'll need to read for a moment before I answer it. Okay. That's a very big question, and I'm not going to give a final opinion on, you know, how religious life relates to issues like LGBTQ or abortion. But if I go back to the first part of your question, I'm in these lectures, I'm not going to be talking about the internet, but in my trilogy of books on the philosophy of Christian life, I do give an important role to our contemporary experience of social media, because I think these have brought about a very, very significant change in the nature of public discourse. I mean, again, to go back to Heidegger says that one of the challenges facing philosophy is that much language doesn't unconceal, it doesn't bring things out into the open, it covers them up. In our average everyday experience of language, remember he's writing in the 1920s, 100 years ago, long before the internet and social media were even thought of, in our average everyday use of language has the character of what he calls Gerede, which gets translated into English as idle talk. And I think what he means here is that most of the time, and a very large part of our link communication with each other, we just pass on phrases we've heard from somebody else, read in a newspaper, on the radio, or on the television. A phrase comes into circulation and then everybody repeats it. Whether this is about something trivial, like the weather, as you perhaps know, people in Britain are famous for always talking about the weather. So it's a nice day today. Oh, it's quite bright, a little bit windy. I mean, these are phrases that everybody uses. Or whether it's about something important, ethical or moral issues. We think through these common phrases, which actually, for Heidegger, don't reveal the issue, but they cover up the issue. And of course, this is very much the case for Heidegger with how we talk about death. The way in which we talk about death in an average way covers up the reality of death. And certainly in the introduction, mention was made of my experience as a parish priest. And I think this is often true, or was true in Britain 40 years ago, that if someone is dying in the family, people will talk about anything except the fact that he or she is dying. How are you doing? Is it all right? Oh, well, tomorrow may be better. That people avoid talking about the reality, and language covers up the experience. And people don't even hear. On one occasion, I visited a woman whose husband had died the day before. And at that time, the popular view was the best death was if people didn't know they were dying. It was best not to know you were dying and just to die. So you didn't have to go through the anguish of knowing you were going to die, and all the fear and the dread. And she said, well, at least he didn't know he was dying. That's good. But then she said, yesterday, he said to me, I'm not going to be here tomorrow. Do you think he knew he was dying? Well, I mean, obviously he did know he was dying, but the nature of the discourse covered up his own experience. And for me, that was a bad thing, that he wanted to bring his experience of dying out into the open. But the way we talk about death didn't allow him to. I think that's changed a lot, actually, in the last generation. And people are now more open about these things. But so language can be used to cover up. And I think that's also one of the problems. And of course, this is even more so with social media, that the kind of things that get put out on tweets, Facebook and so on. Of course, there are good and interesting things. I've done Facebook from time to time. I'm not ideologically opposed to social media. But we all know, I think, from our experience of it, that so much of what occurs on social media, Facebook tweets and Twitter and the rest, stops us having a serious and deep conversation, because language is just broken down into these little phrases and these expressions and these images that don't illuminate, but that cover up. And I think coming to the last part of your question, and so, you know, this is a big challenge, a huge challenge to not just philosophy of religion, but to any kind of philosophy or serious thinking, to any teacher in a university, probably anywhere in the world today, to help students who've grown up with social media to move on to the next step. Now, I'm not denying, you know, social media have wonderful functions as well, but it's a challenge to serious, engaged thinking. And I think that's very true with the sort of topical issues that one gets. You mentioned at the bottom LGBTQ and abortion, that this kind of communication often leads to very polarized discussions, and it does so very, very quickly as well. And stops us hearing the whole human story behind some of these things. So we've recently had a big debate, we're still having a big debate in Scotland about gender identification, because a new law has been passed through our Scottish Parliament that allows basically anyone over the age of 16 to identify which gender they wish to live by without any external conditions. They simply have to register themselves. And this has led to a very polarized debate in which people really can't talk to each other, because there are only two positions, and you can't discuss. Of course, for, you know, young people who are having experiences of being unhappy with the gender that they are, this is always going to be a hugely complex and difficult issue. And, you know, just to sort of say, well, we all know what's going on there. We don't all know. We have to learn to listen to the very specific, very concrete cases. But our discourse covers all that up. It just becomes slogans, flags, mottos, rather than understanding. Going back to Heidegger and idle talk, of course, he would say this in a way, we worry about the social media, but this is exactly the situation in which philosophy began in ancient Athens, with the schools of rhetoric that taught their young people how to argue, how to win an argument, not how to discover truth, but how to win an argument. And philosophy was born, if you like, in this struggle between rhetoric and truth. Today isn't ancient Athens. Today we have our own way of doing this, but in some ways it's a very similar situation. We have these forms of communication we have to wrestle with to find the truth in them. Is that okay? I see a request for another question.
I asked that question of Dr. Eswani, who is the moderator, but I don't know if I can go ahead or not. Maybe he's not here. Maybe he's asleep.
We have about half an hour time, but I don't know. Perhaps Professor Pattison wants to leave the session.
I'm happy to take another question. Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Because I don't see any other person asking any questions, verbal or otherwise. So my question, perhaps it's a kind of reformulation of my previous question, or maybe a new one, but anyway, has to do with the notion of unconcealment in Heidegger's thought. So he kind of defines truth in terms of unconcealment. Then the question to me is whether this is a kind of philosophical undertaking. And then the question would be, why can't he present, or why could have he presented a kind of formulation of truth, a philosophical notion of truth, with which everyone would agree? If it is a kind of concealment which comes through a mystical experience, an existential experience, and perhaps has nothing to do with philosophy, then this is not a philosophical notion of truth. It is a mystical one, which may be discussed by a philosopher as well, no doubt about it, but it is basically and naturally a mystical one. And then another related question is whether or not this is a kind of passive process which takes place itself, something gets unconcealed, or the mystic or the philosopher has to prepare for it. And what are those kind of preparatory steps that one has to take here in order to make this possible? And then whether or not, again, they are mostly mystical kind of preparations or philosophical ones. And if there is any kind of contradiction, which comes first? Thank you.
Yeah. And clearly, many people have seen similarities between Heidegger's idea of, if you like, the experience of truth and mystical experience. And indeed, he himself was influenced by Meister Eckhart and Angelus Silesius and other mystical writers, though in a very second-hand way, I think. And clearly his thought has generated a lot of interest amongst people who also have mystical traditions. There's been a Japanese Buddhist tradition of receiving Heidegger since the 1920s. But, yeah, how can one say? I mean, I think Heidegger himself doesn't think we have to have a mystical experience to see truth. Though from the 1930s onwards, he does give a special role, which again I'll come back to in the third lecture, to the poet. Because for him, it's the poetic word that opens up the world for a community to live in. And that, of course, is not a philosophical world. But he thinks at that point that the philosopher and the poet, if you like, live in a certain, they're a bit like twins, if you like. They're interdependent with one another, that the philosopher doesn't come first. The philosopher has to listen to what the poet is saying and has to be able to be sensitive to what the poet is saying. In the same way, we could say the philosopher has to be sensitive, we go back to his lectures on Paul, to what the religious person is saying, or to what the mystic is saying. But the philosopher isn't necessarily a poet or a mystic or a religious person, but the philosopher interprets what is being said there in a way that at least brings the question of truth into the foreground. And this is very difficult. There's no doubt about it. But I think it would be the case. I mean, I gave the example of Helen Keller, of this deaf, dumb and blind girl who learned language and became a great international communicator, traveling around the world, presenting at conferences and learning to speak. So for her, the world came out of concealment into unconcealment. She was given through language a world. But she lived that world with great courage and inspiration. But of course, she wasn't herself a philosopher at a deeper level. So I think that Heidegger would say that, in a sense, anyone that the philosopher is commenting on and trying to explain what happens, what is happening when people live truthfully in the world, when the world becomes unconcealed to them. They don't necessarily know what's happening. You know, it's famously, he spent a lot of his time amongst farmers in the Black Forest in southern Germany, men who were mostly fairly uneducated, but lived their lives as farmers. And Heidegger certainly didn't want to turn them into philosophers. And he seems to have believed that they were living perfectly good lives, that they were living as they should live, if you like. There was nothing wrong with the way they were living. Though they didn't understand their own lives in a philosophical way. So I think that for Heidegger, for existential phenomenology in general, the lived experience of openness to being, openness to life, comes first, and then the philosophical reflection on that comes second. There's a dependence between the two.
Okay, Professor Pattison, thank you very much for this presentation. Thank you very much again that you invited the invitation of Faculty of Philosophy of Religion of Institute of Humanities and Cultural Studies in Tehran. I hope that perhaps in next year we can see you in person here in Tehran.
Well, that would be wonderful.
Anyway, but anyway, we will have the chance to hear you tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. Thank you very much again. We will have about half an hour until beginning of the next session. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.
Thank you very much.